Mr. Smith goes to confession. The, quote, confession, end quote, given the most weight is the one Conley supposedly made to his, quote, volunteer, end quote, attorney, William M. Smith. Noted Harvard lawyer Alan Dershowitz blustered with certainty in 2004 that Conley admitted to Smith that he had killed Mary Fagan. He wrote, quote, "It seems certain that the actual killer was James Conley, and that his own lawyer knew that to be the case." End quote. A year after Frank's 1913 trial and Conley's decisive role in convincing Atlanta of Frank's guilt, Smith publicly expressed his belief that his client was in fact the guilty man. He felt it unnecessary to explain how he came to that conclusion, but many Frank partisans have on their own turned Smith's opinion into a full-fledged Conley confession. Smith's oddly worded statement was more ambiguous than its overambitious interpreters suggest. Quote, "I am sure that investigation by the proper authorities will prove conclusively that the black is the man who is the slayer." End quote. Smith's statement came in October of 1914, a full year and 2 months after Frank's conviction. The, quote, "proper authorities," end quote, had long ago concluded that Frank was the murderer, and their opinion was buttressed, rather embarrassingly, by Frank's own privately hired investigative, quote, "authorities," end quote, and a series of appeals judges. This alleged about-face by Smith has been presented as a righteous fit of conscience, strong enough to invalidate Conley's attorney-client privilege. But Smith had his own shady motives and suspicious connections. In the very same milquetoast public statement declaring his defection to the Frank camp, Smith explains that, quote, "There were several reasons for my undertaking this work, and one of them was my promise to William J. Burns and," end quote, Burns detective, quote, Dan S. Lehan, "that if the Burns agency would help Mrs. Nelms to locate the girls," end quote. Daughters, Eloise and Beatrice Nelms, quote, "or punish their murderer, that I would give more time than I had to work on the Frank matter, and whatever results I was able to get, I would contribute to the case," end quote. The Nelms sisters were friends of Smith's, and they had been abducted, leaving no trace. He appears to have bargained away the legal rights of Conley to gain the assistance of Burns in solving the Nelms' disappearance. There is no clearer avenue to disbarment than Smith's own admitted motives. Burns, we are reminded, just a few months before, had said that he would prove that Smith's client, James Conley, quote, "is the Jack the Ripper who murdered about 20 Negro girls in the last 3 years," end quote. And he went to extraordinary and illegal lengths to fabricate evidence of Conley's guilt. It was also through Burns that much of Albert Lasker's dirty money flowed into Atlanta to bribe, threaten, and blackmail many witnesses both harmful and helpful to Leo Frank. Smith's client was the main target of Burns's high-octane chicanery, and Smith retaliated with some of the most condemnatory words about Burns's methods in the March 21, 1914 Atlanta Constitution. Quote, "If the papers are correctly quoting William J. Burns, this movie picture, stage lecturing, tangoing sleuth, following his usual methods of playing to the galleries, he must prove not only a disappointment to his employers, but a downright injury to the cause in which he was hired, and for which, I presume, he is being paid. It ought to be to the everlasting shame and disgrace of William J. Burns, should he come here to perform a high service for truth's sake and sacrifice it upon the altar of his desire for publicity. This is no time for bombast and braggartry. For once, give us facts, give us light, give us truth, and eliminate the advertising program, lest you crucify where you seek to save. William M. Smith," end quote. Burns yet got the better of Smith. For several months, Smith had employed the services of Detective Carlton Tedder, with whom Smith no doubt had shared many intimate and confidential details of the case. Tedder was later revealed to have been a planted mole of the William J. Burns agency. though Tedder was later indicted for a host of unethical operations on Frank's behalf, it might easily be surmised that the data gathered in Burns' slimy operation were a factor in Smith's incredible pivot against his own client. Smith's turnabout is all the more shocking when one examines his strident anti-Frank position earlier in the case. He blasted the defendant in a very public way. Comparing his own client's behavior with that of Leo Frank, Smith said, quote, "He is not skulking coward-like behind the protection of iron bars, nor have his lips been sealed with tomb-like silence, until he can spring suddenly in a court, a well-prepared statement, which the state has no opportunity to investigate and disprove. Conley allows himself to be grilled, cross-examined, and unceasingly questioned by the representatives of the state. He is talking and talking now. Conley says to the state of Georgia, 'Here is my story, investigate it, sift it, and prove it a lie if you can.'" End quote. And Smith, here in the midst of Frank's trial in July 1913, refers unflatteringly to the very cabal that he joined a year later. Prosecutor Dorsey, quote, "is fighting brains, money, and influence. I know that he is standing by what he thinks right, and with constant threats thrown at him that they will defeat him at the next election, and with every handicap thrown in his way in the discharge of his duty, in prosecuting a white man who has wealth and influence. It is the supreme test of a man's good character, and I glory in the fact that Hugh Dorsey has those high and honorable traits of his good father and mother that enables him to know the right, and knowing the right, to dare to do it." End quote. It is hard to imagine a white man confronting another on behalf of, quote, "a Negro," end quote, in a more brutally direct way. Smith came to this firm belief in Frank's guilt only after thoroughly vetting Conley's story. It must be remembered that Smith was sent to Conley not as a sympathetic defender of the black man's civil rights, but as a hired mercenary of Atlanta's corporate elite. The Atlanta Georgian, the pro-Frank Hearst newspaper, had paid Smith's meager fee to represent the destitute black man, the paper being motivated by no other reason than to secure inside, quote, "exclusives," end quote. In that duplicitous role, Smith attempted to get the steadfast Conley to change details of his account, and even undertook a number of underhanded efforts to trick his own client. He arranged for a police officer to sneak into a crawlspace over Conley's cell to eavesdrop on him while he was speaking with his visiting wife. But Conley spotted the clumsy intruder, foiling that plot. Smith tried then to deceive Conley into giving him a sample of his fingerprints, presumably so that he could try to match them with other murder scene evidence. In each of these incidents, Conley became suspicious and overcame the scheming of his own lawyer. Ultimately, Smith became a true and very public believer in the state's case against Leo Frank. Little is known about the actual arrangement Smith had with the Georgian, but after Frank's disastrous trial, William Randolph Hearst, one of the world's richest men, became personally involved in Frank's crusade for redemption. And between all those incredibly powerful forces, Smith succumbed to the reality that he might never work as an attorney again. Ever. The ultimate judgment of his character occurred 3 years after Frank's lynching, when in 1918 Smith went to New York and, quote, "accepted a job with the William Burns Detective Agency," end quote, the dead-end graveyard gig for the quintessential shyster. William Smith said and wrote no more on the Leo Frank case until his very last day on Earth in 1949. On his deathbed, he was claimed to have scrawled this statement, quote, "In articles of death, I believe in the innocence and good character of Leo M. Frank," end quote. The script shows that the writer is in deep distress. Yet someone of Frank's agents seems to have prevailed upon a dying Smith to address the Leo Frank case. Smith was alive and well in the 35 years between his abandonment of his black client in 1914 and his death in 1949, but he refused to offer any details about the case in all that time. That fact alone raises real concerns about not only the circumstances surrounding his purported last words, but exactly who compelled him to make such a statement at that critical moment. The final word on the subject of alleged confessions of James Conley ought to be the most convincing, as it comes from one of Leo Frank's original trial attorneys. Leonard Haas was asked about that topic in 1965 by a hopeful Harry Golden for his book on the case, A Little Girl Is Dead, and he responded, quote, "I know nothing of any alleged confession by Conley," end quote. Manola McKnight and the Leo Frank Confession. Quote, "Her first name is Manola. She is a colored woman," end quote. Leo Frank. James Conley never confessed to killing Mary Fagan, but there is a confession on record that contains far more substance than any of those attributed to Conley. It was a confession that Leo Frank made himself in the privacy of his own home to his own wife. It came to public notice by way of the black cook employed in Frank's home. At 20 years old, Manola McKnight might today be in college or have her own business. But in 1913, she had already been working for 2 years as a servant in the Jewish household of Leo Frank, who lived with his wife and her parents at their home. As she put it at the trial, quote, "I work for Mrs. Selig. I cook for her," end quote. The young woman swore in an affidavit that on Sunday, April 27th, the morning after the murder, she had overheard Lucille Frank tell her mother that Leo had admitted to murdering Mary Fagan. Lucille revealed that her distraught husband had been drinking heavily and threatening to commit suicide. In the shocking affidavit, McKnight also confirmed that Lucille had refused to visit her husband in jail for at least 2 weeks, adding to the public's speculation that the suspect's own wife believed him to be guilty. Moreover, Manola McKnight strongly suggested that she had been bribed with extra pay to keep those facts from investigators. Here is the original affidavit McKnight swore out on June 3, 1913, about 5 weeks after the murder, in the presence of her attorney. The detail of her recollection is significant. Quote, "Sunday, Miss Lucille," end quote, Frank's wife, quote, "said to Mrs. Selig," end quote, Lucille Frank's mother, quote, "that Mr. Frank didn't rest so good Saturday night. She said he was drunk and wouldn't let her sleep with him, and she said she slept on the floor on the rug by the bed because Mr. Frank was drinking. Miss Lucille said Sunday that Mr. Frank told her Saturday night that he was in trouble and that he didn't know the reason why he would murder, and he told his wife to get his pistol and let him kill himself. I heard Miss Lucille say that to Mrs. Selig, and it got away with Mrs. Selig," end quote, affected her, quote, "mighty bad. She didn't know what to think. I haven't heard Miss Lucille say whether she believed it or not. I don't know why Mrs. Frank didn't come to see her husband," end quote, in jail, quote, "but it was a pretty good while before she would come to see him, maybe 2 weeks. She would tell me, 'Wasn't it mighty bad that he was locked up?' She would say, 'Manola, I don't know what I am going to do.' When I left home to go to the Solicitor General's office, they told me to mind how I talked. They pay me $3.50 a week, but last week they paid me $4, and 1 week she paid me $6.50. Up to the time of the murder, I was getting $3.50 a week, and the week right after the murder, I don't remember how much she paid me, and the next week they paid me $3.50, and the next week they paid me $6.50, and the next week they paid me $4, and the next week they paid me $4. 1 week, I don't remember which one, Mrs. Selig gave me $5, but it wasn't for my work, and they didn't tell me what it was for. She just said, 'Here is $5, Manola.' I understood that it was a tip for me to keep quiet. They would tell me to mind how I talked, and Miss Lucille gave me a hat," end quote. The notary then questioned her. Quote, question, "Is that," end quote, "the money," quote, "the reason you didn't tell the solicitor yesterday all about this, that Miss Lucille and the others had told you not to say anything about what happened at home there?" Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Is that true? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And that's the reason you would rather have been locked up last night than tell? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Has Mr. Pickett or Mr. Cravens, end quote, both connected to Albert McKnight's place of employment, quote, or Mr. Campbell, end quote, police detective, quote, or myself influenced you in any way or threatened you in any way to make this statement? Answer. No, sir. Question. You make it of your own free will and accord in their presence and in the presence of Mr. Gordon, your attorney? Answer. Yes, sir. Signed, Manola McKnight. Sworn to and subscribed before me this third day of June, 1913. Signed, G.C. February, Notary Public, Fulton County, Georgia. End quote. McKnight's sworn affidavit is, in fact, the strongest evidence of any confession in the case. She soon thereafter retracted her statement under highly suspicious circumstances and turned on the police. Quote, they tried to get me to say that Mr. Frank would not allow his wife to sleep that night and that he told her to get up and get his gun and let him kill himself and that he made her get out of bed. They had my husband there to bulldoze me, claiming that I had told him that. I had never told him anything of the kind. End quote. Here, she is suggesting that she had been coerced by the Atlanta police into making those claims, but Mrs. McKnight's retraction did not include any details of how her elaborate crime of perjury came to be. Her revelation, however, cannot be easily dismissed. Black cooks and maids working in white households from slavery on forward vigilantly listened to the conversations of their employers, often as a matter of life and death. It is through those conversations that blacks heard of plans to sell slaves and slave children, plans to whip or kill another slave, plans of Klan activity, or plans of any other actions by whites that might affect the black community. Lynching plans might first be revealed in the homes of white planners, and it was the maids and, quote, help, end quote, feigning ignorance, who were positioned best to give advance warning to black targets. In fact, Manola McKnight did fully intend to keep this information concealed. She revealed it only to her husband, Albert, who from time to time visited his wife and did odd jobs in the Frank household. It was Albert McKnight who revealed the details of his wife's story at his workplace, and it was Albert's employers who then notified police. The police confronted Manola, leading to the extraordinary affidavit. More telling, the Seligs and the Franks, when faced with their, quote, Negro servant, end quote, publicly outing them in such a damaging way, chose to keep the woman on as their employee. One must question how such a devastating betrayal could be so easily swept under the rug. In effect, she confirmed all that James Conley had told of Frank's hand in Mary Fagan's demise. Far less of an offense had earned a multitude of blacks early graves, yet McKnight reported for work at the Selig residence the very next day. One might accurately surmise that a fired Manola, one with an excellent memory for detail and nothing to lose, could do far more damage to Frank's alibi than an employed and better paid Manola. No servant would have hesitated to tell every negative thing she knew about the Seligs, the Franks, their relatives and visitors, their B'nai B'rith conversations, their drinking habits, their racial and religious attitudes, their gossip, and far more, given the condescending attitude of Mrs. Selig when she testified in court about her wage-paying habits. Quote, I have never raised Manola's wages one penny since she has been with me. Manola was paid $3.50 a week. I advanced her a week's wages. I don't know what week that was. I didn't pay her anything the next week. The first week I gave her $5 and told her to give me the change. She brought $1 the next morning and told me she kept 50 cents, which I deducted the next week. I think Mrs. Frank gave her a hat. I don't know when that was. Mrs. Frank has never given her any money to my knowledge. End quote. Clearly, the purchase of Manola's retraction, further securing her silence, would have been Leo Frank's only option. Another fact of interest that lends support to the veracity of Manola's original story is that her tale would be legally classed as simple hearsay. As truthful as she seems to be, her account could not be used as evidence, and as a, quote, Negro, end quote, woman in the Jim Crow South, she would be all but ignored in any decision involving the fate of a white man. So the question is, why would the police use her to create an elaborate fiction for such a nominal legal result? If the police or prosecutors were trying to frame Leo Frank, as has been charged, and they for some reason chose a black maid, would not they give Manola a far stronger story to tell? Why the circuitous route? Through Mrs. Frank, to Manola's husband, to his employers, and then to the police, only to tell an inconclusive, legally unusable tale? Why wouldn't they just have her say, I heard Mr. Frank say he killed the girl. Or, I washed the blood from his clothes. Or, he gave me the girl's purse to hide. Or simply use her to plant damning evidence in Frank's house, something that would have true legal weight. Police had many, many opportunities to frame Leo Frank if that were their intention, and Manola's story would have been far down the list of effective options. In the end, Manola McKnight's original story was almost certainly true as she told it, and it remains the best evidence of a confession to the murder of Mary Fagan. Ultimately, though, Manola may have had to pay for betraying the trust of her white master. In April of 1914, her face was cut by an assailant, whom she refused to identify, according to reports, leaving her alive but injured with a 5-inch wound. Judge Roan's doubts? On October 31st, 1913, 2 months after the guilty verdict ended the original trial, Judge Leonard S. Roan denied Frank's motion for a new trial, and in doing so, he commented, quote, I am not convinced of the guilt or innocence of the defendant, but I do not have to be convinced. The jury was convinced, and that was enough. End quote. Those 28 words from the presiding judge have been taken by Frank's defenders as, quote, proof, end quote, that the judge believed Frank to be innocent. In truth, Judge Roan was carefully expressing his obligatory judicial impartiality. Had he expressed an opinion, one way or the other, he would have been committing an error that each side could use as grounds to appeal the verdict. More indicative of Roan's actual opinion of the jury's decision was his conferring upon Frank the severest possible penalty, death by hanging. Georgia law gave him the clear option to impose a lighter sentence or even to vacate the conviction or declare a mistrial. But in the very moment he was making that much-discussed statement, he was officially denying Frank a new trial. Nevertheless, Frank and his supporters immediately latched onto the judge's words. Not his sentence or his denial of a new trial, as a form of vindication. Over the years, Judge Roan's name has been attached to a slew of other exoneration falsehoods. Some claim that during an impromptu meeting in the judge's chambers with the defense counsel, Judge Roan is alleged to have said, quote, If Christ and his angels came down here and showed this jury that Frank was innocent, it would bring him in guilty. End quote. And though the tale has been liberally disseminated, the original source is dubious, third-hand hearsay. Indeed, Frank's attorney, Luther Rosser, who was said to be in attendance when the alleged words were uttered, never mentioned the remark, which to a defense or appeals attorney, and to the public relations campaign that soon commenced, would have been a godsend. More than a year after the trial, Roan's sentiments were revived once again when Frank's lawyers alleged that the judge had confessed in a letter his ambivalence about the Frank verdict and his belief that Frank should have a new trial. Roan died of cancer in a Massachusetts hospital in March of 1915, and the letter remained in the possession of Leo Frank's attorneys and was not revealed to the public or to the Roan family for more than 2 months after his death. Here is that November 29, 1914, letter addressed to Luther Rosser's law firm, Rosser and Brandon, and attorney Reuben Arnold. Quote, "Gentlemen, after considering your communication, asking that I recommend executive clemency in the punishment of Leo M. Frank, I wish to say that at the proper time, I shall ask the prison commission to recommend, and the governor to commute Frank's sentence to life imprisonment. This, however, I will not do until the defendant's application shall have been filed, and the governor and prison commission shall have had opportunity to study the record in the case. It is possible that I showed undue deference to the opinion of the jury in this case, when I allowed their verdict to stand. They said by their verdict that they had found the truth. I was still in a state of uncertainty, and so expressed myself. My search for the truth, though diligent and earnest, had not been so successful. In the exercise of judicial discretion, restricted and limited, according to my interpretation of the decisions of the reviewing courts, I allowed the jury's verdict to remain undisturbed. I had no way of knowing it was erroneous. After many months of continued deliberation, I am still uncertain of Frank's guilt. This state of uncertainty is largely due to the character of the Negro Conley's testimony, by which the verdict was evidently reached. Therefore, I consider this a case in which the chief magistrate of the state should exert every effort in ascertaining the truth. The execution of any person, whose guilt has not been satisfactorily proven to the constituted authorities, is too horrible to contemplate. I do not believe that a person should meet with the extreme penalty of the law until the court, jury, and governor shall all have been satisfied of that person's guilt. Hence, at the proper time, I shall express and enlarge upon these views directly to the governor and prison commission. However, if for any cause I am prevented from doing this, you are at liberty to use this letter at the hearing. Very truly yours, Seal, L. S. Roan." End quote. Many, including members of Roan's family, doubted the authenticity of the letter. According to Mary Fagan Keene's book, Roan family members, quote, "indicate that at the time the letter was written, Judge Roan's physical and mental state were critical. They also stated that one of Frank's lawyers went to the sanatorium, and it was at this time that the letter was written and signed by Roan. The family also felt that since Judge Roan refused Frank a new trial, the letter causes some questions." End quote. Roan's own pastor, the Reverend H.C. Emery, said the judge held the opinion that, quote, "according to the evidence, Frank was unquestionably guilty." End quote. Whether the letter was composed by one of Frank's attorneys, as many suspect, or by Roan himself, the text contains the same telltale racism characteristic of the Frank team's defense strategy. The letter's emphasis on Conley as a, quote, "Negro," end quote, as well as the suggestion of the inappropriateness of, quote, "Negro testimony," end quote, was the Frank team's trial and public relations strategy, their stock in trade. The language, quote, "by which the verdict was evidently reached," end quote, raises questions about whether the writer was even at the trial, for certainly Roan would be, literally, the best judge of how the verdict was evidently reached. Also, Roan had not shown overt signs of this kind of racism during the trial, except, of course, that he allowed Frank's attorneys to repeatedly verbalize and demonstrate theirs. In fact, Roan allowed much, quote, "Negro testimony," end quote, into the trial, to Leo Frank's obvious frustration. Judge Roan's words have been liberally misconstrued and even invented by Frank's backers. The Anti-Defamation League attorney Dale Schwartz, for example, made an entirely slanderous assertion in 1989. In, quote, "the judges," end quote, Roan's, quote, "charge to the jury," he said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you have heard the testimony of Jim Conley, a nigger in this case. We all know that niggers don't tell the truth unless they're forced to. And you don't have to believe the testimony of this nigger if you don't want to, against the testimony of white witnesses." End quote. The record shows only three individuals used that kind of vicious racial invective: Leo M. Frank and his two attorneys, Luther Rosser and Reuben Arnold, not Judge Roan. Had Judge Roan composed the letter, it is more likely that he would have allowed its immediate release, given his deteriorating condition and the impending execution of Leo Frank. And he would have released it in the proper judicial forum, certainly not through Frank's attorneys. The Frank team was obsessed with the, quote, Negro, end quote, issue at the trial and in their subsequent efforts to obtain a new trial for the condemned man. Add to that obsession the extraordinary number of letters and notes in the Leo Frank drama that appear in a suspicious manner and at critical times. The false Carter letters. Frank's phony time slip for Newt Lee. Attorney Henry A. Alexander's photographically altered factory stationery. Detective William J. Burns's many false affidavits. And now, belatedly, Rosser and Brandon's alleged Roan letter. All present a pattern of dubiously sourced documents. All for Leo Frank's benefit. It proves Albert Lasker's comments about the actions of his own hired private eye, William J. Burns. Quote, by God, he put in as much perjured stuff as the other side did before we finished. I don't say he did. He had his operatives, I guess. You can run that sort of a thing. Until it embarrassed our case at times. End quote. The Roan letter was just another such embarrassment. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.